Single notification. Upon passage of the bill, we do a special newsletter, as we call it, both for every employer under the system and for every eligible member that we send out to them explaining the provisions of the retirement incentive program. We don't do it as the bill moves through the process because it's always subject to change. But certainly, once it's done, we send a personalized newsletter out to every eligible member explaining the deadlines and so forth, as well as we do a separate newsletter to each employer. So we do take the step to keep them notified.
Senator Duncan?
No, I guess not. I was going to kind of respond to the Commissioner. We're both on the same side of this legislation, so we don't need to get into debate. The administration is supporting it. But, you know, the retirement system should be retained and attract, whatever the term is. On the other hand, it doesn't do a whole lot of good to have a retirement system or retraining and attract people who are going to lay off a couple of thousand people. And that's what this is designed to prevent, is the layoff, right?
Further questions of the administration? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had some other people sign up desiring to testify. I think Mr. Rose, did you care to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Carl Rose, School Board Association. Senators, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you. The Association of Alaska School Boards supports Senate Bill 337. We think with the local option, it provides school districts to examine their state of affairs and determine if the program would be beneficial to the school district as a whole. We think it's an excellent opportunity for the school districts to examine individually. We think that some of the school districts may be able to benefit, and that needs to be at local determination. We've heard some criticism, partly from our own people, feeling a lot of pressure towards this misunderstanding about having to be involved. And I think over the years, with the local determination being specified, they're much more comfortable with the bill now. I think they also recognize that as a result of past RIP bills, it may not be as advantageous for individual districts who've taken advantage of this in the past. But also recognizing that districts that haven't taken advantage of the RIP opportunity now may be able to. So I'll be brief. Simply put, we think that this is a great opportunity for school districts to review their personnel costs and see if this program is beneficial to them and their overall program. We support the bill and look for your favorable support as well.
Mr. Rose, we had there will be an amendment to be offered. I don't know if you've seen the amendment or not, but basically giving local governments or school districts an ability to move up the dates. Did you have a position on that?
I was in Senator Duncan's office this morning. Is this the amendment that was spoken to from Ketchikan?
Yes.
We would agree with that. That is increased flexibility, and we would agree with that.
Questions, Mr. Rose? Senator Adams.
You said this would be a benefit to the school districts. Would this, in turn, show savings that can perhaps help the TRS problems you have throughout school district 65? So with the savings, you can address your TRS problems with this?
I wouldn't go that far. But I would say that there may be some. I think that we have to weigh the short-term benefits in a school district against the long-term goals of a school district. And I think programmatic as well as fiscal. I think if school districts have the opportunity to review that, and it proves to be beneficial, it's a great opportunity for them to create some savings. How those dollars are going to be spent is still a local determination. And I don't know that the savings will be of the magnitude that will offset the current TRS assessment.
Thank you. Other questions, Mr. Rose? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anybody else desiring to testify on this bill? Yes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Willie Anderson. I represent NEA Alaska. We also support the passage of this bill. The points made earlier about the local options, there are a multifaceted of options that are available. First of all, the school districts that we are involved with have the option to participate or not participate, and they have taken that option in the past. Additionally, the employees have the option to apply for early retirement or not to apply for early retirement. And they too have taken that option in the past. So their flexibility is there. It isn't a mandatory participation by either employer or employee, and we support the flexibility. We have some concern about the time to allow that decision to be made. We think that there needs to be an informed decision. The earlier window is one that allowed for an informed decision to be made, with the window from July to December. We have no specific objection to the option of local school districts having a shorter window, so long as the employees have an option to make an informed decision about the benefit of the taking it early retirement and not taking it. So with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Anderson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anybody else desiring to testify? If not, discussion on the bill in general, or we can start considering the amendments. General discussion? Senator Katula.
I think this is probably the best program, speaking just to the educators. When a school teacher is ready to leave, it's kind of like a policeman, you probably better provide some options for them to go. You do lose occasionally, though, some very, very competent person that just getting on the edge, cutting edge of their ability, a person in their late 30s, 40s, that can make a far greater contribution than that person that replaces them can for years and years and years. And it's just one of those things. Of course, they're going to go out a little bit later, and somebody's going to have to replace them anyway. But that's, I agree with policemen and school teachers, brain surgeons, when they're ready to go, probably ought to provide the opportunity for them.
Why don't we, just for organization purposes, there's several amendments in your packets, one by Senator Duncan. Why don't we call that amendment number one? That's Kramer, dated 2/20/92. There's a technical amendment with my name on it. Why don't we call that amendment number two? And then an amendment by Senator Curtula.
I wish to withdraw that amendment. Okay. I sent that down to the senator for his comments.
Okay.
At the time. We didn't get back and forth. I appreciate his point and support it. I think I don't want to get into that.
Okay.
Okay. You'll go down the floor, right?
Mike. Senator Duncan, amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would then move amendment number one, and it's indicated where it should be inserted. What this amendment does is just...
May I object?
Just keep.
Object for explanation on the window so we can all understand it, please.
Right. I was just going to explain that.
Great.
What it does is it does not change, if you look in the legislation, it doesn't change the window periods that are stipulated in the legislation. It doesn't have any impact, let me say, first of all, on state employees. The state employees' window period, the application period, will be July 31st, '92 through October 31st, '92. If I can find the page that appears in the bill, I've got it written out separately.
It's top of page four.
Top of page four. Okay. The state employee application period will remain the same, and their first day they can retire is August 1st, '92, and the employee must retire on or before July 1st, 1993. This amendment impacts the teachers, the university, and the municipalities, does not change the stated window period that's in the legislation. For teachers and universities, they could apply from June 30th, '92 through December 31st, '92. First day the employee could retire would be July 1st, '92, and they must retire on or before August 1st, '93. For municipal employees, the window period in the legislation is application period December 31st, '92 through June 30th, '93. Must retire before can retire by January 1st, '93, and must retire by February 1st, '94. What this does is doesn't lengthen that at all. It doesn't change those. It just allows a local entity, school district, municipality, or the university to adopt a shorter window period. If they want to say that you should be retired on or, you know, at a certain deadline, they can move that deadline up as a local option. So it gives them more flexibility to adjust their window periods. And as you heard, the School Board Association does testify in favor of it. NEA testified that they had no problem with it as long as there was adequate notice given to teachers. So it maximizes local options, Mr. Chairman.
Questions on the amendment? Senator Adams.
Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection.
Further discussion? Senator Hoffman, were you seeking the floor on a general comment earlier?
I wanted to ask a question on a previous amendment that was made in state affairs.
We can. We'll deal with these and we'll come back to that. Is there any objection to the amendment? If not, amendment number one passes and will be incorporated into a new finance CS. Amendment number two was brought to us by bill drafters with the inclusion of the option for the executive director of the judicial system, there was made for the necessity for a title change to include not only PERS and TERS, but also the judicial retirement system, and that's the subject of amendment number two, is simply a title change to reflect the content of the bill. Is there discussion on, I would move, or would somebody move amendment number two?
I so move.
Discussion, Senator Adams.
Mr. Chairman, in section number eight, nobody has shown me that there was a savings that goes up with the grain of this piece of legislation, and so I'm just going to oppose it and show me a savings. Are you doing it just for political, personal reasons, or for what?
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get into a long in-depth debate on this. It's not for political reasons at all. It's a question of equity, in my mind. Everybody who is either a public employee or an employee of a school district or employee of a municipality or a university is entitled or does put into the retirement system, PRS or TRS, and therefore they might be eligible for retirement incentive program. This particular position, Mr. Snowden, doesn't fit into those retirement systems. Therefore, even if he could save money by retiring early, taking a retirement incentive program, he could not because he's excluded. So it's a matter of equity, not for political reasons at all. We're just trying to make the program available to any individual who's employed in public in the public sector. And the bottom line on Section 8 is, I don't know if it'll save money or not. I don't know if anyone knows that. I mean, there's been some runs that indicate it does not. On the other hand, you know, maybe the incumbent in this position decides to make a large monetary contribution of his own. In order to be, maybe it's more for him to get out of the system than it is what it's going to cost him to do that. That's an option he may have available to him. Or maybe there's some other factors that have not been considered. The bottom line is, if it doesn't save money, we'll see that individual back before us next year testifying on his budget. Or maybe he'll just decide to quit. I don't know what he'll decide to do, but he won't take the retirement incentive program if it doesn't save money. If it does save money, that's an option available. But again, that's only after the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has adopted the retirement incentive program and signed off on it as a cost savings for the court system. So it doesn't entitle the guy to anything except worrying about whether he's going to qualify or not.
I might add that because it happens to be one person, we know the circumstances, that under this, the same provisions, that individual would only be buying age, would not be buying total years, that he's already met that, and he would not be buying any benefit increase. It would simply be years to be eligible for retirement. I mean, that's unique because it is one individual case.
On one person, it is very easy to do a run on the cost savings of something like that. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection.
I think, as Senator Duncan indicated, there we probably could do those runs. If it doesn't pencil out, the individual won't be allowed to retire. Is there further objection? If not, amendment number two passes and will be incorporated into a new finance CS. Senator Hoffman?
Yes, on the amendment that was made in State Affairs, why was there the exception to the rule of allowing people that ripped out of the program to contract with the University of Alaska? Was there any justification for that on page 7, line 29?
Senator Duncan.
If I might respond to that, in the original bill, as I submitted the original legislation, I had deleted the prohibition against contracting for all employees. What the administration proposed, and I agreed to, because they felt pretty strongly about it, and I think that was more important than the legislation passed to get their support, was to go back to how the other how the previous program had been structured. This is a provision that was in the previous program, the allowance of not allowing individuals in state government to contract back for a one-year period, but with the university, they could enter into a contract within a one-year period. It happens in university circles to some extent that they can contract with someone to teach one course, for example. They have an expertise in that course. They can contract with someone to teach that course for a very small amount of bucks, but still have the expertise and the knowledge. And it may be important for their overall program to retain that individual on a contract for a short period of time to continue to teach a certain subject matter. And let me assure you that those contracts are very minimal as far as
payment goes, and it seems to be beneficial to the university, and it was in the previous program, and they didn't seem to have any difficulty with it or didn't cause any difficulty. So it's not anything new, it was what was done before.
Well, just because it was done before doesn't make it right. It seems as though that we're just making an exception to the rule.
We are doing that. It's depending on what the rule is, of course.
Senator Couture.
Just speaking in a generalized term to this, we have the slightest of separations to very distinct separations between the university programs and ours. And I can just cite what one other university does, University of California. You can retire. They don't have a RIT program, but you retire, and then you are eligible to teach after retirement one semester a year until you reach the age, I think, 72. They have very distinguished professors, and I know the retirements aren't all that great, but California will be fairly substantial, that they don't want to lose. So they give those specific courses. So they're allowed actually after retirement. In fact, many of them are encouraged to teach one semester a year. So a person retires out of 65, he has 7 more years in which he can teach essentially half time, obviously at salary, with retirement backup. They don't have to, if they're not feeling well, and so on, but several of them do. And I know one specific professor in that category that just, you know, had retired and taught that many years. So it's not unique to our system to provide for it.
Senator Hilton.
One other point on page 2, lines 3 and 4, and I bring this up because of the comments, and I think I share some of the concerns that Senator Capullo had mentioned about individuals possibly retiring at 40, 41, 42. And it states, the sentence states, a plan that results in savings and personal service costs in any amount. And I was wondering whether or not there should be a minimum amount of savings before someone can participate in this program, say $1,000 savings or some minimum level that would be reasonable, and not just leave it to be that he can show 5 cent savings and thereby participate in the program.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would speak against that. We've not done it in past programs, and I think that to take some arbitrary figure may not make a whole lot of sense. I guess $1,000. Who knows what the figure should be? This gives management complete flexibility, and management has to make those decisions. I don't think you're going to find somebody who saves 5 cents. They probably round down to the nearest dollar in that case, which means it would come out to zero, right? So I don't see that as a major problem. It has not been a problem in the past, and I think if you look through the positions, we could get you run through that, you would find it. People who save $5 or $10. I don't think it were anything. I don't know. So I think it's an unnecessary amendment and one that would be arbitrary at what level we would adopt.
Further questions? Discussion on the bill? What's the desire of the committee?
We need to adopt the bill.
Yeah, we do have 2 amendments in the bill.
Have they been adopted?
Yeah, so if we could adopt a finance CS.
Move finance committee.
Is there any objection to the adoption of a finance CS incorporating the 2 amendments? If not, we'll adopt a finance CS. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I would move finance CS presented by the 337 committee with fiscal notes and the definition.
Discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? If not, a new finance CS for Senate Bill 337 moves from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. The next bill before us is Senate Bill 362. Senator Kraft, you've been patiently waiting. Also, Senator Sturgiewski, my apologies, we're running a little slow, but hopefully we'll get to your bill also. Senator Kraft, did you want to briefly go over your bill?
Mm-hmm. Please.
That's a good idea.
Thank you for the opportunity to come before you to explain the rationale behind 362. I believe the state is facing a crisis in voter apathy. The number of voters eligible to vote in the 1990 general election was 300,569 million. As of January 2nd of this year, it had dropped to a little over 287,000. This shows a definite decline in voter participation. By the end of 91, the permanent fund dividend division had received over 359,000 adult applications. The discrepancy between those who are eligible to register to vote and those who received a dividend check is over 71,000 Alaskans. These people, for one reason or another, have chosen not to register. This legislation will provide one more avenue by which these citizens of the state will have placed before them the opportunity to register. We don't want to imply that through this legislation, a person must register to get their permanent fund check. That's not the intent at all. I believe that through cooperation between the Division of Elections and the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, language can be formulated to ensure that this doesn't take place. In closing, I believe the permanent fund dividend application is sacred, and that because of the importance that our society places on the institution of voting, should we include in the permanent fund dividend application and voter registration card. Thank you. And if there have any questions, I'll have Tom Moyer from the staff come up, and maybe the two of us can answer.
Senator Katula. Tom.
If we can make it happen, I think it, I just want to comment, it's a very good idea. It's the best I've seen. Maybe we'll find out that 10% of the people getting permanent funds this voter registration won't apply to. That would be a scary process. But anyway, it's certainly a good idea. I never did like to have to register way in advance of voting. I didn't think that was a smart idea to begin with. We imposed it some years ago. This is a good offset to everybody running around and just registering their particular party.
Mm-hmm. Senator Adams.
Senator, do you mind if there was a sunset clause that is here, perhaps? I know this to reevaluate the program in a year to 2 years to see if it's actually working.
We talked about that and thought it's a possibility. We surely can do it.
Just for the Senator's benefit, in Senate State Affairs, we had some discussion about that, and there is a letter of intent from the Senate State Affairs Committee. One of the parts of that was to report back on the effect of the program at least 2 years. Senator Adams.
You know, it's just that we're getting the many statutes in the books, and I just, with this sunset, then we wouldn't have to do anything. If not, we'd, you know, be passing these repealers all the time. I just wondered which was easier. That's all I was asking.
Well, as you will see from the next bill up, we also, when we pass sunset, have to pass another bill re-upping these programs. So it works both ways.
What is the estimated cost of fiscal note?
$16,000.
We have representatives from Division of Elections, right, and also Division of Permanent Fund Dividends. Both have testified in support of the bill. The fiscal note would be by elections who would pay for it and then administered by the dividend office. If anybody desired questions, we have representatives that probably answer questions on that. Other questions of the bill sponsor? Not. Senator Kraft, you're welcome to remain at the table with us. Was there anybody desiring to testify specifically on 362? Discussion on the part of the committee?
You ready for a motion?
Senator Katula?
I move the legislation to replace that committee with individual recommendation. I should ask the Senate.
There is also a letter of intent.
I move the letter of intent.
It's been moved to report out 362's state affairs with the accompanying letter of intent and the fiscal notes. Is there discussion? Is there objection? If not, 362 with the letter of intent and the accompanying fiscal notes passes with individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, I move for a 2 minute recess to move around.
Yep. Why don't we take 2 minutes?
Stand up.
Hey, Rick.
Yeah. Department is strongly in favor of Senate Bill 355.
The ARTA program basically, the purpose of the ARTA program is to facilitate economic development at the regional and at the local level by setting up a statewide network of designated regional development organizations. And the philosophy of the program is that economic development takes place at the local level. And the whole basis of the ARTA program is founded in this area. The benefits of the program are basically that the ARTA program provides the structure through which local governments can coordinate, can pool their efforts, and deal with economic issues and opportunities. The program provides the means for a public-private partnership, so all interested parties can be involved in their efforts. Also, the program provides a mechanism for local input into state economic development programs and policies. Finally, the role of the department is to work with the ARTAs, and several things that we do. We administer the $50,000 matching grant program on an annual basis. We provide ongoing help to the ARTAs. We provide monthly meetings with them, on-site visits, and an annual educational workshop. And I'd like to ask Stan now to sort of fill in some of the blanks. I'd be certainly happy to answer any questions as well.
One of the things that I have a question about that really is outside the scope of the ARTA program, that when we get into the Commerce Subcommittee on the budget, I want to know more about the change in funding from federally funded positions to now generally funded positions. And I recognize that this is not, the fiscal note is for just informative reasons for the future and doesn't apply to the 93, but
sure.
I think our committee wants to know a lot more about that funding and what the role of the department is in the ARTA program beyond passing the checks out in the mail, and, because it is a difference in, I mean, it's an impact on the general fund for the positions within Commerce now. Senator Couture.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the fact that you have that interest in the committee with some direction there. It's all too unfortunate that the vast federal programs to Medicaid on, slowly but surely, the federal contribution is eroded. Nationally in education, they tell me it's 17% reduction in federal support in programs they've initiated. And here's another one. And the state can only pick up so many. I'm not speaking to this one. This may be the exception, but we've got to be very concerned about these federal programs. They whet the appetite and develop constituency. And the state doesn't have funds. They take money from education to provide services. So I appreciate your review is what I'm saying.
Mr. Stedman.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Stan Stedman. I'm the executive director of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Economic Development District, and we'll cut that down to EDD for ease in the presentation here. I do appreciate the opportunity to meet with you and to represent my peers. Because of other organizational activities and meetings, there are several of my peers here in the audience today, and I'm sure, for time permitting, you may want to hear from them. I would like to just make a comment at the outset that I think that I will be addressing the question that you have just raised to some extent from our local perspective and how the state fits into this role. I'd like to first of all say that our organization was actually formed prior to the ARTA program. We were formed in the spring of 1988, and then when the ARTA program came online, we were the first ARTA designated under the program. Since that time, there have been another 12 ARTAs formed, five in 1991, and so many of the programs are still in their infancy. But in this three-year period, I think that we've seen some dramatic accomplishments in empowering private industry to overcome barriers that exist for them to accomplish economic development goals and to be successful. You have, I believe, in your packet materials that cite some of the examples of accomplishment of ARTAs, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on those, but I just cite a specific example in our area. In the spring of 1989, we began an effort to educate people as to the potential of additional oil and gas production in the Cook Inlet, and focused in on the potential of LNG production. And we didn't achieve our objective of LNG production, but we did sensitize people to the investment potential in our area. When Stewart Petroleum was seeking funding for their project, Wildcat Drilling Project in the Cook Inlet, we were able to link them up with one of those investors that we had identified. And with that investment, they were able to go forward. We think that that maybe is a trophy on the wall for our activity, and we can cite many others, which I think you have information on there. Going back to the beginning, when we began, we had a partnership arrangement, not with the state, but with the federal government for our funding. We provided the bulk locally through our local governments and received some assistance through the U.S. Economic Development Administration. However, from the outset, we saw the state kind of pounce on the opportunity to gain information through our program and to work with us in delivery of their programs. So there was a real weak link here. The state was really not a financial partner. And due to the inspiration and insight of some of your members with the leadership of Senator Sturgiluski, that gap was quickly filled. And the funding aspect of the ARDR program certainly was critical to our startup, as it has been to all of the ARDRs. But I would like to suggest some other dimensions to the program beyond the $50,000, and I think we'll deal with maybe some of the questions that you've expressed here. Beyond the funding, another dimension is the networking opportunity. And the ARDR program has brought us together under the leadership of the ARDR state staff and allowed us to exchange information, to engage in synergistic activities, to go back into our areas and be creative, bring our findings and our successes back to the other ARDRs. And just citing a couple of examples of how that's worked in our regard, we have adopted the New Roots program that was pioneered up in the Fairbanks based ARDR program as our program as well. We are looking to the Kuskokwim's Native Crafts Cooperative Program as a format for our cooperative activities. We have been involved in export and product development activities pioneered in the Southeast ARDR. We are undertaking shortly a networking communication program for a newsletter that we're patterning after the Swampscene program. We look to the Anchorage program for leadership in private partnership development. We are looking to the Copper Valley Group for what they're doing in their partnership with Rural Electrics. And also in the Arctic area, we're looking to what they're doing in the Anituvik Pass area in lodge development. So there's been a lot of synergy developed here. Also, we have been working closely with the ARDR staff developing rapport with state agencies, and we have made progress in tailoring programs that they deliver to our local needs. Also, we have, through the conferences that the staff has developed, we've been able to develop rapport with our peers outside of the state, and we've been utilizing three different economic development corporations as unpaid advisors to our operation on an ongoing basis. The third dimension to the ARDR program is technical assistance, and working with the state, we've been able to use them. I think we all use the state as adjunct faculty to our programs. And I think you're going to see headlines out of the Kenai Peninsula in the very near future as to how we're dealing with the beetle-kill timber situation, which is a statewide concern, through a cooperative effort involving the state, the federal government, and our local ARDR program. So there are these three important dimensions. We would urge you, and I have a resolution to share with you from our ARDR, that the program be extended, that the funding be continued, that the opportunity to nurture the existing ARDRs be continued, and that the strength of the partnership with the state be continued through the funding. I just would make one final comment, and that is regard to a position taken by AML to increase the funding to $100,000 for each ARDR. We have not taken any position on that, nor have we at our local ARDR level. But I think the question comes up as to whether that is a prudent idea, and all I can say is that I think that that we've demonstrated that with the limited state dollars, we've been able to greatly leverage those dollars to bring in foundation, private, and federal dollars. And I think the money has certainly been well spent. I also think that some of our arbors struggle. We feel almost oppressed at times with the great demand for our services at the local level and varied level. And some of our arbors are in dire need of additional staff and don't have the private business base from which to work from to develop that staff. So those are just some thoughts relative to that idea, but again, we're not taking a position either at my level, at Kenai Peninsula, or at the peer group level.
Mr. Stedman, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate the examples, too. I think that's something that we always are wondering what exactly are the arbors doing, or what exactly is the Commerce Department doing to help. Appreciate those examples. Questions of either Ms. Blossom or Mr. Stedman? Senator Couture.
This could be a vehicle if it's properly managed and doesn't get top-heavy all the way through, as many government-sponsored things tend to. Could be a vehicle of really cooperating with the villages and the people, where an exchange of ideas and knowledge is really important. I really think that this could be that vehicle for economic development that's been talked about. Now, it's just three quick things. That cooperative exchange you expressed in a different way, I was going to ask a question on that. I'm glad to hear the initiation of and a little of the result. There's three thoughts here that I just want to throw out because somebody's got to pick them up this one at a time. Vermont, you know, is a $500 million program of cottage industries. It's in the New York area. I just think a cooperative effort to market, if you can get volume, is really important right down along the West Coast and into Los Angeles. We have all kinds of projects and problems and arts and crafts and materials, including sending perch, blocks of birch down there to compete with the pine from Colorado on the market for fireplaces. It's just all kinds of things that could be done because we have an empty, Larry Carr alone had 100 vans a day coming and going, all of them returning through Los Angeles empty. I could just see some of these materials with some cooperation and so on, one stop here to load, one stop there to unload, even bulking materials, just things like this that could really help some of these small towns, communities, at least those that are near the roads. I think that type of discussion is really important to getting economic development going in the areas that are represented, from Homer to Senator Schultz's area. Obviously, the arts and crafts and so on, those high quality and volume markets. You also ought to think about the Russian extension for the future. Obviously, the Nome warehousing of supplies and materials for barter, exchange, and sale back and forth across might do a lot for Nome. And I know there are others that go directly, wholesaling directly out of Anchorage, don't believe that, but I still think that exchange would be a real value in that area. I'll quit it. If you do the right thing, you really are going to contribute to this state. If you become a bureaucratic morass, just drawing on funds for no real good purpose, then it'd be a mistake, and a loss.
Mr. Stedman?
I, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, I appreciate that comment, and I know that there are examples in each of the areas, but just let me say that the native crafts cooperative, we're working with the timber products on a very cooperative local level, the shellfish mariculture level, where there isn't within individuals the strength to pull together, or the strength individually to accomplish the marketing. And also we have recently entered into a relationship with the Olsky region of Russia, and we'll have our first exchange of business people arriving in May from Russia. And so this kind of thing is already happening, and I see it happening in the other region.
Senator Adams?
I support the ARTA program with the, under the grant lines of $750,000. That was on, one of them had a fiscal note of dated 2/7/92, which I'm going to move for. There was one on 2/24/92, which then put in three more people. But as you know, if you go back into the budget as it is, Mr. Chairman, there is 9 development specialists, and basically we should be utilizing other expertise out there in economic development. We have duplication. We have in Perry Eaton's shop of CEDC, we have specialists in there that can help rural Alaska, and basically we will be cutting the budget, but I hate to see when we put up something that could perhaps hurt the program. And so I just ask for somebody on this, why we need 3 more specialists when we have 9 that is presently ready here in the budget book.
Let me just preface that was part of my opening remarks too, that's an item that we are definitely going to look at in the Commerce Budget Subcommittee. Mr. Lawson.
If I could, what we're doing right now, those 3 staff are on board right now. However, they are funded through a federal grant, which is matched by state CIP funds. And there's an indication that we will not be getting a grant in the future. And so year to year, we're sort of up in the air on that. I can go into much more depth, but I can say that for next week if you want. So.
Yeah, I think we definitely want to look at it, and also not just the funds, but we want to look at the CIP funds to see how those are competing with the other match grant programs. I assume by CIP you're talking about the $800,000 economic development match grant program.
Correct.
Yeah, I think, well, I'll just tell you, I'm very nervous about using those funds to fund people within the Department of Commerce, and clearly that doesn't directly relate to, I think, how we view that program operating as just grants to, you know, local entities for developing new small businesses or economic ventures. We can, we'll get into that. Other questions? Thank you very much. Was there anybody else desiring to testify on this bill? Yes, sir.
Chairman, my name is Jim Kohler. I'm the executive director of the Southeast Conference, which is the ARTR for Southeast Alaska. And I wanted to direct my comments not so much to the ARTR legislation that's in front of you, but to some of the questions and comments that have been put on the table this morning, and in effect to offer you or extend to you an invitation. Whether it's the ARTR in Kenai or in Southeast or in Southwest, we have managed over the past few years to generate anywhere from the Southeast Conference, as an example, $200,000 to $300,000 worth of budget activities during the course of a year with the $50,000 seed money that comes to us through this program. And we do that effective this year. We are at the highest staff level, which is 1 full-time equivalent. We are not top-heavy. What we are, though, is street smart. We do know that regardless of where you put money, where you put energy, economic development only happens on the street. And that's where the ARTR's strength is that we do work on the street and we work with people that are trying to get things done and make them happen. We become a liaison to them. We become catalysts. We offer technical assistance. We're more than happy to spend some time showing you and demonstrating to you how we really do make economic development activity happen. But to some of the comments that have been put on the table, the Department of Commerce and Economic Development over the last couple of years has, I think, begun to learn how it is that they can be the most supportive and help and make ARTRs work. I must confess, though, that learning curve is a little bit steeper within some of the other programs and agencies throughout the state. And as you take a look at some of the very important questions that Senator Sturgalewski has put on the table and that I have heard reinforced by some of the comments here this morning, if nothing else, invite us back. Commerce has learned how to use ARTRs. Development activities and business people and municipalities and small cooperative organizations on the street have learned to use the ARTRs. Invite us back, and we would be more than happy, I think, to share with you some of the directions, that some of the coordination you're looking for in terms of how to make it happen, what would work at a very specific kind of level. So we invite you, now that the ARTRs, I think, have become a success, and I think we've demonstrated that success, to come back to us as well and learn how to use us within your deliberations on how you look to keep focus and keep the kind of energy and synergism and efficiency in terms of economic development work throughout the state, to keep that at its peak. We're more than happy to meet with you one-on-one, at a group level, at a special kind of a meeting or session, but we are here, and I think we've demonstrated a lot I think Commerce has learned, and we just simply invite you to use the resource that you have developed and created as well to help you.
Well, thank you. You didn't mention what agencies have a steeper learning curve, but I would sure hope that Senator Adams in his review of the CRA budget might utilize some of this input and seeing what those guys are doing or not doing and going around the state. That might be an area. Senator Cotullo?
Well, if we had qualified people reviewing efficiency in government, they'd have contacts like yours, which would allow them to reduce certain segments of duplication or non-productivity and perhaps concentrate on some of these more closely related to private sector. I don't like to use the oft-used and overused comparison word, but that is the truth. Just one little thing, and I'm going to throw it out there because somebody's going to have to start paying attention to it besides just the legislature. We talk about economic development, and it has so many aspects. I'm just going to throw one small thought out there. Last year, this committee put $45,000 into reindeer inoculation, absolutely vital. One for the protection of the caribou, and two for the protection of the reindeer. The Russian counterparts have been doing it for decades. We've done it off and on intermittently and not well, but you have to have the money, and it certainly is a government responsibility. Okay. In Europe, all over the nation, people want reindeer properly marketed. Herb Ekman has come to me with practically tears in his eyes already 15, 20 years ago. How do I get more product? How do I get good quality product? And all these things we work at, red meat law and so on coming into effect. You could help immensely on that too. But the point is that you're not going to get any advance in the reindeer, which is the economy of some of these rural areas and of the Anchorage area, it contributes mightily. Unless you're going to give support to some of these needed functions somehow or other within the governmental system. They cut that $45,000 down to $15,000, and the department must be damned if they want to handle it all. They don't understand why it's part of their responsibility. You know what that's going to do, quite obviously going to do. It's going to provide for non-productive herds that are less economic, and they'll provide maybe for tuberculosis infection, which will mean it unusable at any, et cetera. Those are little things that you ought to be touching base with when you get into economic development. It isn't just only the marketing end and distribution end. It's also that sort of thing. I hope somebody gets into it besides just us.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Was there anybody else desiring to testify? What's the desire of the committee? Is there anyone?
I would move to fill out with individual recommendations. This is just the authorization.
Yeah.
To take budget funding.
Correct.
For next year.
FY93 is in.
It's in at the funding levels suggested for future years in the fiscal note. But this fiscal note is zero for 93.
Are you going to send out a zero fiscal note, or are you going to send out one with the grants and claims of $750,000?
We're going to send out a zero fiscal note for this fiscal year. All that money is currently in the Commerce budget,
okay,
including the grants. The rest is, I guess we'd have to say, informative as to future costs. Is there, I'm sorry, was there a motion?
Yes, there was. And
I'm
the motion
sorry.
Was to move the bill out of individual recommendations and with the zero fiscal note, I assume.
What the fiscal note was prepared?
Yeah.
The fiscal note that was prepared, which one? Do we have the funds now in the Commerce budget? Hence, we don't need them in this budget.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have a zero fiscal note, only it does technically have a zero fiscal note.
It will be handled through the budget process, through the Commerce budget.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, let me make sure I understand. Is the fiscal note we're going to put on the bill going to be the one that's a zero fiscal note or one that's in our packet?
The one that's in the packet.
And it is dated which day?
2/24/92.
2/24/92. So I will move that fiscal note.
Is there objection to the motion? If not, Senate Bill 355 moves from committee with individual recommendations and they come with a fiscal note. That concludes our business. Thank you.
And there was a special extra request beyond the legislation that was before us by the Department of endorsement, I suppose I should say, by the Department of Fish and Game, although it came through Cheryl Fresca's signature. Cheryl, could you and the Department of Fish and Game come up and brief us on why this should be fast-tracked? It's the $216,200 and it's dated February 28th. And you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Beth Ray, who is the director for the board, is here to speak to that question.
Mr. Chairman, the problem is really lost federal funds. We just found out 2 weeks ago that we were not going to get any federal funding, and we had planned on getting somewhere between 200 and 250, even though we had been budgeted for 400,000. And we had adjusted our program anticipating that lower level. And as I say, 2 weeks ago, we were informed that we were not going to get any. And it's sort of, obviously, it's kind of an awkward period since we have a Board of Fish meeting right now. We have a Board of Game meeting scheduled to start on the 19th of this month. And we've got advisory committees extremely active during this time frame. So we're really sort of caught very much by surprise.
Senator Adams.
Seemed like in the last budget process, you were able to find money for the two deputy commissioners that we eliminate. Can't you find this $200,000 for this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that obviously is another BRU altogether and a very different story.
Thank you.
It's all dollars, state dollars. Are there any other questions? All right, thank you very much. There are no further questions on that component. I'd like the audit division of the last, is the auditor, state auditor here at this time. Please come forward. You have in section 21, legislative audit division, a supplemental request because of governor's cuts previously and, of course, state audit just constitutional responsibility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Randy Welker, legislative auditor. As you just stated, Mr. Chairman, we're requesting $200,000 of a $421,000 veto to our FY92 operating appropriation. The veto was a 15% reduction to the audit division. Last June, the Budget and Audit Committee met, considered the impact it would have on the audit division's operations and instructed us to proceed as normal, but as prudently as possible. We do have a $150,000 reappropriation balance, but that's not enough to get us through the end of the fiscal year. Mr. Chairman, as you and I have discussed in the past, I think the audit division plays a critical role in the legislative process. And I believe without this $200,000, the audit division would virtually come to a standstill during the month of June of this fiscal year.
Yeah, I think it's undue administrative interference in the separation of powers in this particular case. If they do bring you to an absolute end. I see the court smiling over there. We are not necessarily consistent. That's the hobgoblin of the small mind. any questions? If not, we'd like to go to Health and Social Services. It's a rather large request. Is there who is here to represent the ADFC? Federal and general fund receipts. And just briefly, what's happened here that we need this supplemental?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Janet Clark. I'm the Director of Admin Services for Health and Social Services. Jan Hansen, the Director of the Division of Public Assistance, is here. She just stepped out of the room. She'll be back. However, the AFDC supplemental requirement on the early supplemental is basically due to increased caseloads. I think in your packet you've had some handouts. I think Jan can talk about it a little bit more. But in the last 2 years, the program has experienced, let me back up just a minute. Historically, AFDC has a reduced number of caseload in the summer. It increases in the winter, and in the summer, the caseload decreases. For the past two summers, the caseload has not decreased in the summer, and so we've just continued with increasing requirements.
Have you run any survey, or do you have any estimate of why it has not decreased now? We're bringing more people up here. What's going on?
Mr. Chairman, I think Jan Hansen can speak to that a little better than I can.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Jan Hansen, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. Mr. Chairman, we know that a great deal of the caseload increase is from people staying on the program longer. That is not new people coming in. It's that
those who were on the program did not go off of it in the anticipated seasonal decline. They stayed on the program longer so that the October caseload figure was higher than the May figure. Always in the past, by October, we were about 300 cases below where we had been in May. So that part of the caseload growth is not new people coming on. We find that to be a correlation with the economic downturn and the fact that the economic downturn in Alaska right now is congruent with one in the lower 48. Previously, when we had a downturn here, some people would leave, but there's nothing for them to go to elsewhere, and so we find people staying here longer and staying on assistance.
Another question? Is there ever any effort in the think tank of the administration, HESS, cabinet, figure ways to reduce this expenditure and still fully service the people, get them out quickly? What's going on?
We're giving a considerable amount of attention to what we can do to reduce this figure. The primary tack that we have taken has been to ensure that we do not allow ineligible people on the program. We run a very tight program with strict verification, and our quality control that we have 97% case accuracy when the federal government only requires 94%. That's one of the where we put a lot of our energy has been in making sure that we don't pay a percentage of AFDC funds out to people that don't qualify. We are also looking at who these people are. One of our primary ways of attempting to move people off of the program is through the jobs program, which is a welfare to work part of the welfare reform package, and that's a continually expanding program by federal mandate, and that program has an increased number of people participating in it each month. We now have about 800 participants in that program, moving them through employment training to ultimately get off the program.
Other questions of this component? I know that the Budget Committee is meeting now on this whole system again. If there are no questions, we'll go to education. DOE request, it's in 470. It's also being in the fast-tracking. It appears to need some fast-tracking. You can speak to the Foundation Program request and to the adequacy of that request or how far that's going to take us.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dwayne Daly, Division Director of Educational Finance and Support Service for the Department of Education. In Section 33 of House Bill 50, we have a supplemental request for $19,087,000. That request was based upon first quarter student counts that were due the fourth Friday in October of the current school year. At the present time, we have information from the second count period in draft form that indicates that this request is approximately $2 million short of the total need for this school year. Their current approximate.
What is the total need for this school year, in your opinion? Well, and it doesn't have to be fast track. But
just slightly over $21 million, sir. Approximately $2 million more than the current number requested.
Are there questions of this component, of this gentleman? We've had you in on a continuing basis the last week before the committee. And this would be an incidental, but I think we all well understand it. There are none. We'll give the court system a couple of minutes.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the court system. I would note at the beginning, this is only the third time in 12 years that we've asked for a supplemental. Last year was the second time.
But our memory is real fresh. That's
Mr. Chairman, the $622,000 requested represents, first of all, some positions that just had to be filled, that the court system did fill. For example, custody investigators in Anchorage and Fairbanks. Cases were 9 to 12 months delayed. And in court for Bethel, we've had to be sending pro tem judges up there, and because of the heavy caseload, we have one in court for the two resident judicial officers and the pro tem coming up. That's the 300. That represents about 341,000 of the 622. Another $164,000 is for the A&S litigation. We've not got funding to handle this major litigation coming up in April. Court remodeling starts Friday of this week. We have had to keep a law clerk on this case. Over a million documents have been filed. Some of this money will come back to, from the general fund. The judge has ordered that some of the courtroom renovations that we don't consider absolutely necessary be paid for by the parties. The law clerk, because of the continuance that was granted in this case, and we've had to keep that law clerk on extra time, at the end of the case, some of those costs will be apportioned to the parties, so some of that money will be coming back. The remaining $116,000, Mr. Chairman, is basically range 8 types of positions across the state where we have had very, very high caseloads. They're for temporaries, Homer, Cray, Cordova, Kotzebue, Ketchikan, Barrow, Anchorage, or range 10 secretary for the, because we only have one secretary for the 5 custody investigators. They're all based on very high caseloads that we had to fill positions in. And the, as I said, the last 116,000 is temporaries to help us catch up with the tremendous backlog. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? There are no questions at this time. Most of us understand the court problems. Next, corrections. Brief from corrections. And we'd just like you to go over ABC here.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dana Watts. I'm Director of the Division of Admin Services for the Department of Corrections.
If you can speak up a little bit, thank you.
Okay. This particular supplemental request is just for one area within our program, for inmate health care, sometimes known as major medical.
Are you speaking to the other sections of corrections?
No, I'm not. This is just section 19 of
All right.
your House
Please
Bill
proceed.
50.
Please proceed.
Currently, this particular component in each of the years since fiscal year 1986 has received a supplemental appropriation. It's basically short funded at the beginning of the year in anticipation of specific receipts. And this particular year, we have estimated a little over $2 million to fund the program through the remainder of the year. Currently, we have processed 3 revised programs just to keep this program moving along. That, in fact, has created a shortfall in one of our other components. But right now, we are holding on to about $800,000 of pending invoices, and we would like to process those as soon as possible.
Questions this component? There are no questions. Thank you very, very much. You have the floor, Senator.
Maybe, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going through the packet by the administration, and there's a, on the last sheet from Division of Public Health, on a supplemental request, they're calling something fast-track supplementals for the WIF program. Maybe, could
yes.
Ms. Frasca
Carol,
answer
could
that?
You come up and...
Is that part of OMB's request for the
Carol,
fast track? That's not our understanding originally.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Which request are you looking at?
There's no reference number to the section, but it's the a WIC program, a general fund program receipt supplemental, but it's entitled Fast Track Supplemental.
Yes, yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Porcho, that was addressed by a revised program legislative.
Oh, it's an RP.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we originally had included it as a request. But
okay, thank you. The other one is then the Department Administration on why we have before us the increased rentals, the Department Administration being, you know. It's Section 32, Leasing Program.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Brooks. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Admin. The $3.6 million supplemental is for contractual costs associated with leases for all state agencies. We knew going into the beginning of the fiscal year that we had shorted the budget. In conference committee, it had been shorted a little bit more. And we estimate that this amount will be needed by April 23rd to make scheduled payments to lessors around the state.
Now, there is some rumor floating around that the Park Administration, the governor, and others are looking to unburden us of much of the rental programs by varying methods, but by ownership, again, of certain key and continually functioning offices of this administration.
ownership is one thing that is being investigated, Mr. Chairman, as a means of reducing the budget. In a lot of cases, we've paid for buildings several times over through the leasing budget, and it makes sense to start putting some of that money towards purchases. So there are some buildings being looked at. There are no definite plans at this point to purchase any particular building.
Well, I understand the use of ADA may come in and the state may purchase some buildings, may build or purchase some buildings, or a combination.
Well, that's true. I've heard the same thing. I haven't been in on those meetings myself, but I have heard that ADA potentially could be a source.
Tell the commissioner we are interested in that potential presentation.
Okay.
As a method of eventually saving money or at least acquiring ownership so that rentals eventually end, if in fact the depreciations then don't exceed the rental costs, et cetera.
Okay, I will relay that to her.
Are there questions of other components? I don't wish to slight anybody. This is purely the fast-tracking portion. There will be a subsequent supplemental, and that supplemental can be initiated by the Senate or House. There is a supplemental in the House already, and that's administration's Bill 470. But we're looking at those components that have been suggested by the administration that are needed to pay bills currently. And many projects, even in our own area, that undoubtedly will fit into the supplemental needs time, we're not considering at this time because we have not gotten a revenue projection from the administration. We have our own revenue projections. We've made our own calculations, but they're inadequate to the task at the moment. And we don't know what funds will be available and where they're making differences between what we can do to adequately fund basic government services, health, education, highway maintenance, and so on, and where we're going to have to make those tough decisions if, in fact, our present revenue projections hold. To that end, I would like the co-chairman to recognize him at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share your views, and I would have to say there's a couple of items in the House passed bill that are of real personal interest to me, and I would love to see them included. They were originally scheduled in the second supplemental by the administration. The problem is, it seems like that as we're becoming more and more aware of our budget problems, that it seems like we're potentially getting into a situation where we might fund something as a supplemental for 92 and then have no money to continue the program in 93. And on some of these things, I would rather try to continue a program next year even at a reduced level rather than it's the same money we're spending now that we're going to be trying to utilize in 93. So it seems that we need to take the most fiscally conservative approach at this time, recognizing that there would be another supplemental. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm inclined to go with essentially the administration's fast-track request at this time. And are you ready for a motion?
I'm ready. I'm ready to entertain a motion, Mr. Chairman.
I would move a new finance CS for House Bill 50 that would include the following sections: Section 19 relating to the Department of Corrections, Section 21. 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26 relating to the legislature and reflecting, by the way, of the 15% cut taken last year, which was by far the largest of any agency. Section 29 relating to the Department of Law, oil and gas litigation. Section 32 relating to the Department of Administration leasing shortfalls. Section 33 relating to the Department of Education shortfalls in the foundation program for this year, and Section 34 relating to the shortfall in aid to families with dependent children.
You move that be prepared as a committee substitute?
Yes, sir.
Does everybody understand it?
Yes, sir.
Is there a motion for adoption of committee substitute at this time?
Mr. Chairman,
you have the floor, Senator.
Just one clarification. I assume that we also need Section 37 with the section numbers renumbered.
Right, and Section 38.
And Section 38.
Pardon me.
And have we included the fish and game, or is there another motion on that?
The motion was to adopt the CS, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
That was a motion for the CSS.
Without objection, the committee substitute has been adopted. You're all aware you have the exact sections before you. They are not numerous, and we've had hearing testimony on them. Are there other, with the adoption of committee substitute, which we recognize entirely what it is, there is a motion presented, Mr. Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make an amending motion to add another section for the sum of $216,200 is appropriated from the general fund to the Department of Fish and Game for advisory committee and regional council activity for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 1992. I might note that from Senator Adams' district and my district, the boards have been meeting. They haven't been coming up with our viewpoint, the right decisions. Hopefully that we can see some change, and I know that they are addressing it, but I would move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
My understanding they're out this month, period. Any objection? Without objection, unanimous consent. I call unanimous consent. Are there further motions? We may have some technical, but I do not believe so. We'll have this made up and ready for the next meeting. Ready for your signatures. The committee substitute has been adopted. Do you wish to move it out with individual recommendation this time? Or do you wish to see it first?
I think we should move it out.
I think we have to move it out. Senator Duncan moves it out with individual recommendation. It will be brought before you in classic fashion.
No, you can take care of it.
Smart woman.
We are to order, and the first day of the discussion on budget reduction proposals comes from the Department Administration. And any updates or any second thoughts you had to your previous testimony and previous exercise in the House, given you a day or two at least. So the Commissioner of Natural Resources was distressed to have to come right back in after testifying last night and come back here tomorrow. Or I guess it's Wednesday, really, so he does that today. No, it is tomorrow.
Actually, it's rather nice to keep it fresh on your mind.
So we are engaged in trying to figure out what is necessary and what's affordable, and you have broad range and you have the floor, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I am extremely pleased to be here. I think that obviously this is going to be all of us working hand in glove. And
I had asked the OMB representative, Stastny or Cheryl or whoever, to come to the table too. Why don't you? You probably work in and out. And even the Commissioner Administration might feel better if you were not sitting directly behind, out front and exposed.
Well, as I say, Mr. Chairman, it is a pleasure being here because I think that while none of this is very pleasant, it's only going to be through a cooperative effort that we can make progress. You know, when we're looking at the kinds of numbers that we are, whether we agree on $200 million or $150 million or $250 million, that's not pocket change, and we're not going to find it by cutting a couple of positions. We're not going to find it by ratcheting down operations and cutting back on our paperclip budget, which is not to say that some of that can't still be done. Obviously, there are still many organizational issues that we have to approach. But we're not going to find the kind of money that we are going to need without looking structurally at the programs that are offered and how they're delivered in the state. As we went through the Department of Administration, we went into our analysis with three basic tests. One is this a constitutional or core government function that must be provided? Secondly, does it provide for those truly in need who are unable to care for themselves otherwise? And then thirdly, what impact will it have on the overall economy or marketplace if we were to impact this program? So as we put our heads together, we started looking at a variety of things, applying those three tests.
I don't think that we're going to be making, using Harold's favorite term, a draconian approach to some of these things and be able to sustain an economy. We have to be sensitive to that as we go forward. I have handed out to you what I would call an idea sheet. These are not necessarily proposals or recommendations, but more ideas for kicking around and giving us a frame of reference for discussion with regard to the Department of Administration. Obviously, we have both procedural and administrative functions that through consistency and changing procedures, we can, in fact, achieve some incremental changes across the board, some incremental savings. I use examples of timesheets. You know, right now we have positive time reporting. Every employee in the state, every pay period has to fill out a timesheet. You know, in this day and age of electronic reporting, we should be able to have exception reporting. This is something that we can, through the Department of Administration, change procedurally. Now, that's not going to save you two employees' function. That's going to save every employee in the state 5 minutes, you know, twice a month. But there are incremental things that we can do. Obviously, personal services is a key area that we can look at and help both procedurally and in this case, statutorily, and through the collective bargaining process to hopefully achieve some efficiencies. Some of the things that we have put forward are, these are ideas that have come from my staff, from my management team, and from legislators that we've talked to throughout this process. As you know, collective bargaining agreements are all up this fall, and although we can do some statutory alignment, anything that we would do in the area of personnel would be subject to the bargaining process and reaching agreements with the public employees' unions to be able to achieve savings. So I think it's important to enter into that understanding as we go forward, that we can all agree on something, and if we don't have the third party to agree, nothing's going to happen. So, personnel. A suggestion had been made at one of my early hearings with regard to the merit pay system. We discovered it looking at that. They were saying, well, you know, it's the merit pay system. Aren't we paying isn't that really a misnomer? And people get a raise every year just because they're there, and the standards really aren't adhered to very well. And we went back and took a look at it at their request. And the answer was that there are some mandatory federal requirements for maintaining the merit pay system. So that option really wasn't available to us. Any employee that is paid...
What was that quote? The mandatory...
Federal requirements for a merit pay system. Any employee that is paid with federal dollars must be operating under a merit pay system.
Does it recognize the collective bargaining aspect? Is any amendment to that directive?
Were it not, as I would understand it, Senator, were it not for the for this tie-in to the federal dollars, we could, through state statute and collective bargaining, address the merit pay issue. But because of this federal requirement that all federally funded employees must be operating under a merit pay system, it sort of threw it out of the ballpark for...
Is a merit pay system, is it one like ours, or is it a merit pay system that could just reward those that are truly meritorious each and every year, like 1,000 statewide?
There is no question that management can do a better job of implementing the merit pay system that we already have. I don't think we do the kind of job that we should in terms of setting standards. Whether our standards are the same as the Fed's, I don't know, and I'd be happy to go back and check that.
It's okay. I didn't realize that we had that.
Chairman, I didn't
yes,
really
do
today.
You're not staying on this area for a long time.
No,
I think also, I'd have to go back and look how it's worded. But the Constitution talks about the merit system of employment also. So there's a constitutional provision that you're concerned with. Maybe things you could do underneath that provision, but it's not just a federal requirement.
Right, it's the collective bargaining that's not the law or the Constitution.
No, I think our state Constitution talks about a merit system of employment.
Yeah, it does. Never tell us how to introduce it, but it tells us.
I guess the short answer is the reason you don't see merit pay on this list was because we eliminated it for a variety of reasons. However, having said that, if we are going to operate under a merit pay system, what options did we have? And the options that we have, and I guess that this makes sense to me, is, if we're going to have a merit system, why do we also have a seniority system, which is the longevity pay? You know, we went into this with the approach that if we have a longevity step scale, we didn't need the merit system. Well, we can't do away with the merit system, so let's keep the merit system and eliminate these longevity steps. That does have potential. There are four steps beyond the highest step that can be achieved through the merit system, which are strictly for seniority. That is statutory, and it is also subject to collective bargaining. So, for example, if the statute was changed between now and this fall when we begin bargaining, it would certainly send a signal to those units that it is the intent of the legislature that we're going to stick with the merit system and not going to longevity. There would be some savings there. You know, it's an indirect savings for personnel. It's not coming directly out of our department, but it would be across the board. And I might also mention that these are soft numbers that we've put before you. Some of these are guesstimates. But so the longevity steps would be an option that would be across the board personnel. 35-hour work week. This was an interesting proposal. And with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to sort of burn through these, and then we can, however you want to do it, it's fine with me. A 35-hour work week. I thought it was an interesting proposal that bubbled up from one of the employees in our department. And the idea being is what we're trying to do is minimize the impact on the state and the overall economy, that if we could reduce the number of work hours, let me take you back. If you'll recall, we got a 37.5-hour work week as the result of a no-pay increase proposal. For no-pay increase, we took off 2.5 hours a week. This would be sort of an extension of that, only we would say we work 2.5 hours less a week and we get paid that much less a week. And it would be almost an across-the-board 6.7% savings in personnel costs. Now, you know, one approach on this, obviously we would have to get a memorandum of understanding from the unions and that sort of thing. We would preserve jobs. It could be on a one-year time frame. It would be an immediate savings that would come right out of our cash flow. I mean, this is money that isn't going into paychecks. It's a cash situation. It had some intriguing qualities, and I think as we go through these, we find that these structural programmatic changes still will take a year or two to really achieve the direct savings. If we have a cash flow problem, and we don't want to send the state into an economic tailspin, I think that this is a serious consideration that we could talk about on a temporary basis. Now, I certainly wouldn't recommend this as a long-term strategy, but if it comes down to a cash flow issue, I think that this is something that would be kind of interesting. Retirement and benefits. This came out as a result of our meetings in House Finance last week. A couple of the members were talking about the retirement program and the fact that employees right now contribute about 6.5%, and the state contributes about 15% to this defined benefit program, retirement program. Frankly, in this day and age, that's out of line with what's going on in the private sector. There are more and more large companies that are going to defined contribution programs, and certainly the matching element is not as generous as we have now. Now, constitutionally, we can't reduce the benefit to the current employees. However, through statutory change, we could change the components, change the contribution levels of the employee and the employer, for example, go from 6% to the employee to 8%, and then 15% for the employer down to 13, which still would be a generous program. The benefits would remain the same. Something like that could apply to new employees coming into the system. And I think it certainly has some merit. You know, as I suggested to you at our last encounter, it seems to me that with the number of pieces of legislation that are pending this session and almost every session with regard to retirement and benefits, it just simply makes sense to me that we take a look at it. Maybe we can come up with some kind of an overall fix that could address this and bring it into the 21st century. RATNET, one of these programs that is a classic anachronism. RATNET fulfilled a need that no one else was available to fill at the time that television was fairly young in this state. Today there is cable. Today for $1,200, people can buy a satellite dish for that they stick up in their backyard and can pick up almost any signal going overhead. Public broadcasting goes into many of these communities. Is this a system that, in fact, we can afford to maintain? It's not necessary. It's not really commercially viable. The emergency system aspect of it, I keep being reminded that the public broadcasters consider themselves to be fulfilling that role in many ways. The Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is constructing a new emergency communication system. We have down here the rather drastic option of just unplugging. I'm not sure. As a matter of fact, I tried to cut a deal with the public broadcasters and suggest that in lieu of a grant, we just give them RATNET. And they weren't wild about that option. But I think that it's one of those programs. How long can we afford to maintain it? I think it's something that we have to look at in the long term. Telecommunications, disconnected Kenai TV. This is another one of these things. It's on the list not because it's a statutory problem, but just because I think it's one of the interesting things that points out and demonstrates the kind of system that we have. Again, this is an anachronism. There was a time the state provides a translator service down to the Kenai Peninsula. There is room on this translator for three signals, which was perfectly adequate when there were only three television stations in Anchorage. Now we have five television stations in Anchorage.